This is the Gator Nation Football Podcast with your hosts, Alan Williams and James DeVirgilio.
This place is an insane asylum in the swamp! Oh my!
Now we know we're just a bunch of average stiffs.
Well, Gator fans, that was a wild one. Welcome to the Gator Nation Football Podcast. My name is Alan Williams, right here next to, as someone likes to call him, the illustrious James DeVirgilio. We're glad to be back with you guys this week. Big Gator win up in Knoxville. We're going to break it down for you. We're going to talk why it happened. What does it mean for us? We're going to look ahead to Mississippi State. James, thank some people for us.
So, as I like to say every week on the opening of this podcast, thank you so much to those of you that support us on Patreon. If you are not supporting us on Patreon and you want to give us a dono, there are three sizes, Alan, of donos: small, medium, and large. And this past week, we have a couple of new patrons. Taylor LaCroix comes in a large dono at $7 a month. Taylor, thank you. That's absolutely fantastic.
Large dono.
We also have Tim Tebow as a small dono.
And, come on, Tim.
Tim Tebow is very creative, right? I think, Tim, you could afford more than a small dono, but Tim's email was also listed as Tim Tebow something at Gmail, so I could not figure out who you are. But to the alternate Tim Tebow, thank you for the small dono. And as always, we will thank our top supporter, Alexander Leventhal. You can contribute whatever you want per month to the show. And each week I'm going to read out Alexander Leventhal's name as the top dono because he's the man. We appreciate that. Thanks so much for the support. I know he told me via direct message last week that his friends get a big kick out of that. So it's going to keep on coming. But thanks so much.
Enjoy.
If you like the show, like us on Facebook. Obviously, join. There's more than 15,000 now, Alan, listeners of this podcast each and every week.
Join,
so you guys are in great company. And if you don't want to support us on Patreon, that's super cool, by the way. Alan and I get tremendous amusement and joy out of the fact that some of you are supporting us on that platform. So with that out of the way, let's turn our attention to what was a glorious football Saturday for us Gator fans. Alan, both you and I picked the Gators to win very close.
24-20, 23-20.
And 23-20. We thought the game could go a million different directions. We did say that we thought there was a better chance the Gators could blow out Tennessee. And if it happened, it would be a wild game filled with turnovers and other things. Our keys to victory were rushing yards and then turnovers, being the old football cliche. But I think when you get two teams like these together, that's probably accurate. That's exactly what happened. Five turnovers from Tennessee led to a 47-21 win with the Gators, putting Little Peyton's record now at 11-1. He watched the game with Alan and I at my house. He was facing the TV the entire time. Got a good snapshot of him, of course. So he'll go back into the closet until next year. But Alan, 47 points is the most we've scored at Tennessee. Rather surprising. Was this entire game just super surprising to you?
Yes and no. I mean, I was hopeful. I kind of had gotten to the point before that day where I was pretty amped about it, and I was hoping that this was going to be the way the game went. Everything I was reading about that told me, the way I was looking at the data and the discussion, is that we have a chance to freaking crush them. I don't know if we're going to be able to do it, but I was hopeful. And this game was crazy, crazy. I don't want us to lose track of how nuts. If you think about all of the things that happened in the first quarter and a half, essentially, usually you don't get that kind of stuff in three games. And we saw all that. I mean, I lost my voice by halftime from screaming, just from the insanity of the game. Tennessee talked about dying on the hill. They did. They did, I think, try to pull out all the stops. They probably would have done more of the game being closer. You know, the onside kick early on, the trick play kind of on early's creative call and fourth down. They went for it in some sense, but this game was nuts. Let's talk about the biggest of those big plays in terms of swinging the game. There's a lot to choose from. James, if you had to pick out one, what would you say?
I'm going to leave the most obvious one for you, Alan, and I'm going to say maybe the biggest in terms of the absolute nail in the coffin play. So we go up 16-3 on a safety, courtesy of an excellent punt by Townsend, and then we promptly score one play later on a little scramble out by Felipe Franks on a short pass to Freddie Swain, who, in one of the weirder touchdowns you'll see scored, evades the first man near the sideline and then just outruns three Tennessee defenders. It's impossible to understand how one of those guys did not have an angle on him. But I think once we went up 23-3, given the momentum of the game, given the frustration Tennessee fans were feeling at that point in time, I knew at that point in time the game was over. I knew that we were definitely going to win when that happened. But Alan, there's a bigger moment that occurred before that that I think really changed the complexion of the game, especially emotionally.
Yeah, and I'm going to point to the fourth down, I'll say conversion, but they didn't really convert it. Tennessee goes for it on fourth and one, fools us, slips a tight end on the backside of the play. He's wide open, and I'll say props to C.J. Henderson for not giving up on the play, chasing him down, causing a fumble out the back of the end zone, which we've talked about. We hate that rule. Really helped the Gators on this moment. Tennessee went from kind of getting back in the game for a second to, oh, man, like we just got our head stomped on here. So that, I think, completely took them out of everything that they wanted to do. And I don't know if that's – you can pick a lot of turning points in this game. You, even our first touchdown to the fact that we got a lead probably helped us a ton. But for me, when I look at the biggest play, that's probably it. And I think that puts into, you know, clarity both Tennessee's incompetence and our hustle and effort in the game, which I think are the two things I would like to highlight. James, I don't know. This is interesting. We talk about a game so filled with turnovers and big plays. How much of these turnovers were being caused by us, and how much were we just benefiting by circumstance, kind of getting lucky in a sense?
The example you just gave, maybe the pivotal play of the game, was entirely a hustle play by C.J. Henderson. And we'll give you a spoiler alert, and we'll just actually put the whole movie out there right now. That play went like this. It's a fourth and one look for a fourth and two or three, Alan, from Tennessee look. And they slip out their tight end, who's actually as a fullback, like an H-back at the start of this play on the left side. C.J. Henderson is manning his receiver on the edge, and he runs a dig route, so a 5 or 6 yard dig route. He chases him all the way across the field. Shortly thereafter, Brad Stewart at safety also engages that same man. Now, it's impossible to know whether Henderson was supposed to be in man or Henderson was supposed to be in zone passing him off to Stewart, or Stewart was supposed to come down and take a backfield guy. Clearly, somebody blew a responsibility there. There's no need to double-team a man in that situation. But what's amazing about this play is when Tennessee's tight end catches that football, C.J. Henderson is at midfield. He's in the middle of the field. He turns around, recognizing, hearing the crowd, essentially, that there's a large play coming, runs him down, makes the perfect hit, which is very unfortunate for Tennessee in that scenario. The player did nothing wrong. It just happens. And then, Alan, the worst rule in football comes into play. I mentioned to you as we watched it live, it's so great to celebrate a rule that we talk about on this podcast that you've mentioned every year when we do our off-season series about this is the rule that needs to be changed. And it dramatically affected the game. It dramatically affected the game. I definitely am with you, Alan. That play should not be a touchback. If we can't get on top of the ball and it goes out of the back of the end zone or the side of the end zone, it certainly feels like it should be their ball on the 2 yard line. That's how I feel like it really should be. But with that being said, the hustle play there is big. If C.J. Henderson does not make a 100% effort immediately, that's a touchdown. And that could change the whole game. It really could. So I think it's important to note that a lot of the turnovers we are getting are generated by us. We're going to walk through these turnovers in this podcast today. And a couple of them inevitably our luck. Certainly we can't take a lot of credit for Tennessee snapping the ball off the quarterback's leg and then we fall on it. There's really nothing we did to generate something like that. But the majority of turnovers in both the Colorado State game and this game have been forced by us, whether on special teams or on defense. And I think that's a drastic change from what we've seen, especially in the past year, but really in the past several years on defense. The turnover rate we're generating now is historically high.
Yeah,
I doubt that will continue.
It should regress a little bit.
It will come back down some, but either way, at some point in time, the emphasis of this staff was to put turnovers as a big part of the game plan each and every week, and it's happening. And I don't think that's totally on accident.
Yeah, I mean, last year we went games without creating turnovers, even though there are still some of these same guys on the team. I'll take the first one. You know, Polite comes around the edge, gets a huge hit on Garantano, pops the ball loose. We're there to, I guess, quote unquote, intercept it or collect the fumble, however you want to rule it. We got the ball in the right place at the right time, but had the pressure. And I'll say Luke Ingram, fantastic job of reading the play. I mean, it was about as simple of a read as you can make as a defensive lineman. And then I don't know what Garantano was. He's looking right at him and threw it right at him. But he still had to drop back, be in the right spot, and catch that ball as a defensive lineman, which is not easy. So both, again, us being in the right spot and capitalize on Tennessee's stupidity. Okay, this is weird to talk about this again. Another game where our total yardage is so strange compared to how many points we put on the board. Our third down conversions, that kinds of things. I don't know. Does that matter? Do you look at this game any different than you did last week?
It's amazing if you look at the stat line between Colorado State and Tennessee. They're almost identical on our offensive numbers, which is truly just bizarre, given that you could have a bizarre game like we said, that's kind of an anomaly last week, and repeat it again this week. I'm going to borrow from Nick Saban here. Nick Saban's gone on the Trash the Media tour on Sunday and Rat Monday. Poison. Yeah, right. He's very frustrated that the Alabama only beat Jimbo Fisher's team by a mere 22 points, and he wants to let everyone know this Alabama team is not the best team of the century or ever. In fact, they're flawed. But he does have a point about something. And what Nick Saban has been saying is when we face better opposition, if the team thinks that we're just going to win because we're Alabama or because we beat Texas A&M or because we think we have no flaws, they're wrong. They're wrong. And that's the same thing here, Alan. If we just think that these offensive numbers, that this third down conversion percentage, that our completion percentage on our quarterbacks is not going to affect us down the road against better opponents, if we delude ourselves into saying it's a short field, it's the way the game's been going, we're lying to ourselves. Efficient offenses don't do this. So absolutely it matters. It will come back on us at some point in time. But I want to make an aside here to say, I think Dan Mullen is aware that we're very limited on offense. And I think it's very, very smart of these coaches and the way they've been coaching these guys to attempt in any way they can to score points and assist the offense. And that's been happening. That's been happening. And that's been huge for us winning these ball games. Any coach is going to win more if they're able to get a shorter field. And that's doubly so if your offense is what it is. But don't lull yourself to sleep thinking that that stuff doesn't matter because the game was quirky. It definitely matters, and it will matter at some point in time. It could matter as soon as this weekend, because Mississippi State is by far the most talented defense that we've faced. And Kentucky, of course, did a good job on us, but Mississippi State's in a different level than Kentucky, even though, Alan, we're going to talk about Kentucky. You could argue Kentucky's defense is peaking at this moment. So, main narrative coming out of this game. Safe to say that Tennessee is terrible and Florida's just okay. It's hard, in fact, to find any other narrative if you're not a Gator fan and you're telling yourself there's a different one. If you look at the national media, if you go to the Tennessee message boards, which are fun, go there, read articles, read it from their own press. That is the narrative. Is that narrative accurate? Is it just that Tennessee was really bad and in reality we're just okay?
I think so. I think Tennessee is pretty rough. We even talked about comparing their talent levels to UF and it being kind of similar. And that was taken into account. They had this mega top five class, and most of those guys from that class are gone. I don't think that they're as talented per their ranking as they actually are. So I think we're a little more talented. I think we're better coached. I think we're better equipped to make plays on offense, and we have a significantly more talent on defense, I think. They looked lost out there. We tend to kind of wash over the first-time coach thing because some first-time coaches are good. I don't think anyone pegged Jeremy Pruitt as a prodigy. He might get this thing up and running, but they're nowhere close yet. I will say I think Tennessee is bad. Again, like we said, Florida was a four-win team last year, and it's still showing up. Tennessee went 0-4 in the conference. That's showing up. You don't come out of that and change overnight. It's hard to say about how good we are. I think people thought the sky was falling after the Kentucky game. I personally didn't. As much as some people out in the world were, I was not thrilled, obviously, and I was, you know, kind of a little bit down on us and moved our win expectation back a little bit. I think these last two performances have shown me that we're able to take advantage of other teams' mistakes, and that's something that teams that are on their way to being good, at least, will do. I think it maybe is because people are saying Florida and Tennessee are both terrible. Kurt Herbstreit said first team to 10 is going to win. I don't think we look like a first team to 10 kind of team. I think Kentucky's win over Mississippi State illustrates that, and we're going to talk about that some more. So I would push it a little more further. I wouldn't go so crazy and be like, Florida's back. Look how awesome we are. We crushed a terrible Tennessee team. But I don't think it's just that we're okay. I want to put us slightly above that.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And the reality is that we don't have a benchmark that's reliable to go against. Kentucky is an unknown, impressive, moving up. We don't know what to make of them yet. Mississippi State losing to Kentucky, that's an unknown. It's a coach that hasn't coached at this level before. We don't know. And Tennessee, like you mentioned, dumpster fire last year. Probably dumpster fire this year. Certainly looks that way. How do you know? You haven't played a Jimbo Fisher.
Not enough
or
data.
A Nick Saban or a Kirby Smart or even a Missouri or anyone that can give you some look of like, okay, I have some idea where we stand. But I think it is safe to say that a narrative we're going to talk about today, and we said this after the Kentucky game. I wasn't here, but you know, I texted it to you. We talked about it next week. We expect Dan Mullen to improve this team week to week. And I think for me, the quarter poll takeaway is that the team is improving week to week. It's not going to be perfect. We're very limited in certain spots. But you are seeing a coach who understands his limitations, knows how to work with the roster. And if nothing else, Alan, something Mullen mentioned in his presser today was that he wants his teams to play tough and to be tough. And there was absolutely a noticeable difference in our team's mental composure and level of toughness versus Tennessee's. You could see it. You could feel it. That was not the case under the McElwain regime. And under the Muschamp regime, it was disorganized chaos. So I think you see that, you feel that. But no way to know if we're more than just okay at this point in time yet. All right, let's get into the game analysis. This week, we're going to spend some time on a couple of points here and there. The game had so much to offer us. But in reality, Alan, there wasn't really that much on film that was all that different from last week. And so last week, we went way in depth into all these things we noticed against Colorado State. No need to do that 2 weeks in a row, but a couple of things we want to pick on. And what I want to know, Alan, is did you think the offense made an improvement that you could see from Colorado State to Tennessee?
I'll say slightly minimal. I would say yes. The offensive line continues to be a work in progress. I'll say less throws from Felipe. We'll get to him in a minute. That looked like they were nowhere near his target or he totally biffed the play. I think we're seeing the coaching staff continue to figure out who does what well. So minor improvements. It's hard to go this thing noticeably improved and we got way better if you look back since Kentucky. Better, but I'm not nothing that I'd be willing to stake and say we have vastly improved and here's the evidence. What about you?
I think what maybe shows up on film here is that this was a road game in an extremely hostile environment. Mm-hmm. Tennessee seemed as loud as they have been in the last decade in the opening quarter. And I thought the team handled that with a lot of poise. And that's new for us. Colorado State didn't offer that challenge, but I'm going to say they handled the road challenge pretty well. We're still heavily penalized as a team in general. But all in all, they were composed. There weren't a lot of boneheaded penalties or things you were thinking, gosh, why are we doing this? And then secondly, week to week, I think I've seen the offensive line improve the most. And don't get me wrong, if I'm grading them out in the Tennessee game, they're still probably a C or a C+. But there's definitely tangible improvements between missed assignments and kind of the basic things you can control. We had several plays in this game where we actually got a good push against Tennessee's front, which is not terrible. But it's very minor. Like you really, Alan, have to like dig deep to figure out where the improvement is. Now, I want to highlight two things before I ask you about one of your guys, if you will. Popped on film, Scarlett's running was great in this game. He had two runs in particular, one of the first ones of the game, and then touchdown running where he just carried four or five guys, all hustle, all effort. Stuff we know he can do. Good to see him do it in a competitive game against Tennessee. Tyree Cleveland shows up. As we're watching the game, I actually look over to Alan and say, hey, you know what's missing this year is Cleveland doing anything vertically. I know Dan Mullen wants to use his arm, wants to get in those throws. I know that people really can't run with Cleveland down the field. And then we get sort of a nice one-on-one jump ball that Cleveland takes into the house 5 seconds after that. So it's good to see him show up. But a guy who has showed up in every facet of the game is the guy that you once highlighted, Alan, as your breakout player last season. But I got a lot of text jokingly over the weekend saying, was Freddie Swain even on the team last year? And if so, what the heck were we using him for?
Well, they have moved him to the slot, and I think he's benefiting a ton from that. That he's getting better matchups against guys he's much quicker than. So either a slot corner, linebacker, safety. When he's on the outside having to beat the other team's maybe best corner one-on-one, that's not really his skill set. Now, he has guys like Van Jefferson and Cleveland on the outside giving him a little cover, and he's much more effective. He's a heady player. He got to that spot where Franks could get him the ball and the touchdown. Impressed by that. I think he's carved out a nice little niche on this team. And again, the coaches are figuring out how to use people. We've seen it with Tony a little bit. They're figuring out, even getting down to play calling a little bit. The first play of the game was a run play to Scarlett. I think it was the exact same play that I highlighted was our first good run play the week before. They saw that. We blocked it well. Scarlett reads it well. So I think they're figuring out what plays does this team execute well at this point. And we know what those are. Those are go-tos. We're more effective in just regular down and distance when we're doing the stuff that we're good at doing. Now, there's still a lot to be learned from that. But again, little improvements. And then, of course, this week we got the weekly tradition, Pierce's garbage time touchdown run. James, is it just garbage time, or does he need to be getting the ball more in the first half?
I think he needs to be getting the ball more in the first half. I think they're concerned with, like we mentioned last week, all the other things that you have to do, right? Pass blocking, etc. And certainly the hole he ran through in garbage time was, but you know, you could have driven a truck through that one. A lot of you listening to the podcast could have scored on that one. But the previous ones he scored were not that way, per se. But I think it's clear that he is shot out of a cannon. And he's got a great instinct for how to hit the hole. And that's a lot of it, right? He makes a good first read, good first step. But I think they're going to continue to try to get him more carries. Maybe he was a guy you considered at the start of the season redshirting because you said to yourself, hey, I've already got three guys ahead of him that have experience. Then you have a foot injury, take one out. Now you got two. And now this guy is knocking on the door for playing time. He's actually our leading rusher right now, Alan, total yards wise. And so again,
he's got like five carries or something.
Yeah. I mean, he's got enough to be dangerous, but I do expect to see him getting some earlier work as the season progresses, especially if he can prove, like we talked about, knowledge of playbook. He certainly hasn't fumbled yet, so that's good reason there. But always fun to watch him finish things up. All right, let's talk about a play that occurred in the game, maybe our only true significantly negative play on offense, if you will, is the fumble by Perine. It's a zone read look. Franks hands it straight to Perine. Perine gets drilled by a corner blitz. Now, I watched this on film like 50 times in a row. And I don't know what other people are putting out there, but I'm confident if they tell you they know what happened, they're lying. It's impossible to know where the fault went. It's a good call by Tennessee. You could argue, okay, well, at that point in time, the offensive tackle is supposed to recognize that. It would have been Taylor on the outside. It doesn't look like he gives any recognition to the blitz. He sees him line up there. They're not really even disguising it. Then you could say, okay, well, it's Franks' job to make the read. Franks is not reading the corner on that play. It looks like he's reading either the Mike linebacker or the weak side linebacker, in which case he's still handing it to Perine based upon his key. Or lastly, and this is where I don't think we are in the playbook yet, Alan, is traditionally there is a receiver on that side. The corner blitzes from that side. If we can reach this level, and this is why I'm highlighting this play, that'd be a run-pass option, where Franks would be reading the blitz. And if he feels the blitz, he pulls the ball and he throws a quick hitter where the blitzer came from. I am very confident we are not to that level yet. But I'm also thinking it's going to be a great piece of film illustration for the team this week, because we need to get to the point where we can do those sort of things. Regardless, when you watched that play live, you thought, man, that's terrible by Perine, or man, that's terrible by Franks, or man, that's terrible by the O-line. I cannot assign blame to one particular person there. So it's one of the few plays where you can really say, I really don't know. I'd have to know what the play call was, what the protection was. Was Frank supposed to call protection if they blitz? There's a million things we don't know there. But not bad in a big rivalry game on the road where the offense did not perform well. And there's certainly other plays we can pick on. Bad throws, bad reads, not good protection calls. But the only really egregious play on the road that was poor was that one. That's a pretty good day at the office.
Yeah, I agree. And we continue to talk about when they do something, we kind of get why they did it. Even if it doesn't work, maybe it's because execution, maybe because the defense makes a great play, or maybe Franks makes the wrong read. But at least the play call makes sense into the situation. I know you wanted to highlight one. It's that third and six run call where we handed to Scarlett going left, and he gets bottled up. We don't pick up the yardage we need. Looks like kind of busted. What were we even going? It's kind of an interesting call to make there, running on third and six.
Yeah, we stopped this one live and looked at it five or six times because right away you think the visions of last year come into your mind if you're watching at home or you're watching there in Tennessee and you're thinking, oh man, why are we ever running the ball on third and six? But in reality, that was the perfect call. That's probably a touchdown if we execute that play correctly. The look that we had was eight of our guys in the box versus six of theirs. Tennessee was absolutely expecting pass, 100%. And post-snap, they played pass. Unfortunately for us, Heggie has to make a large pull block on the left side. He kicks out, doesn't get there in time, whiffs the block entirely. Play blows up. But if you watch that play, if you go home and you freeze that play and the blocks, a hat for a hat's accounted for, that is almost certainly a 20, 30-yard gain or a touchdown, especially if the receiver on the edge holds his block. So good play call, poor execution. And it's a good example of kind of just where we still are in Mullen's offense. And for me, a guy who's a passing guy, I'm in reality a numbers guy. And we've talked about this a lot, Alan. Good offense is taking what the defense gives you. It's at the right time running the right play based upon what the tendencies are. And we absolutely caught Tennessee in the perfect look for that play and got nothing out of it. So sometimes you have to go beyond whether it's a run or a pass. And what's been fun about this season, and we're going to give Mullen some more props here, is we haven't had to spend all this time talking about why the heck are we running these plays at these times. Most of the play calls have been very solid numbers-wise. So that's solid there. Alan, anything new from Franks? I don't have anything new on my end. I think he looked exactly the same as he did against Colorado State. One thing that I'll note as an overall positive for him, since you know I tend to sort of be down on him as a ceiling level quarterback, he's definitely improved. We've called those things out. On the road, he did a very, very good job throwing the ball away. I thought he leaves the pocket too early at times, doesn't recognize blitzes quick enough, but all in all, one of the most important skills for him at this stage of this team's development is just simply to not have huge negative plays. There were four or five times where he just rolled out, threw it away. That was not what he did last year. He's clearly improved drastically in that, and that makes a difference in the game. But aside from other things, if you're thinking to yourself, has he really gotten better? Has he done these things better? Did he make more reads? No, pretty much where he was in the Colorado State game. It's a slow process, I think, with him. But if he can go on the road and not throw picks or turn the ball over, I think that's all you can ask for at this stage of the Florida offense. Did you notice anything new? Anything you liked?
Well, you got a note here that he now has the most carries on the team. We were using him in those short yardage situations where you thought maybe we use Emory Jones, where he's keeping the ball and running it, either on a QB draw or a zone read. And I was a little concerned about, can he pick up that stuff in short yardage? He's a lanky guy. Can he get low enough? Now, one time we saw him hilariously jump in the air while the guy was still standing up straight and get body slammed. It's like, please don't ever do that again. You're not hurdling someone who's standing up. I don't care how tall you are. But he's a willing runner. He got his nose in there. Those were some tough yards a couple times. So that's good. Yeah, we didn't have a lot of reps this week. You hear Mellon talk about that. You know, we're not getting some people the ball as much, not enough touches. We're barely running any plays because we have these short fields so much. But no throws where he's like, man, that should have been intercepted or that was wildly crazy. Maybe he's not making the optimal plays yet. This is hard. We're talking about this guy week to week. It's like one of those cases where I, you know, kind of in someone's development, you would want to like watch him. It's like, is your kid getting taller? If you look at him every day, you're like, no. But then you come back in 6 months, it's like, yeah, he's a lot taller. So hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have seen a lot of improvement by Franks. Game to game, he improved a little bit. Hopefully that will stack up. Right now, it's not going fast enough. Hopefully that will begin to multiply exponentially as he puts more of those pieces in place. But it's hard to say that he's good enough at this point to really lead us to victory. Now we're hoping that he doesn't cause us defeat. And I think he's kind of at that level. He played well on the road. You know, the whole team did in that atmosphere. Now, again, we had a huge cushion early, but that's a good step for them, a good positive note for them.
Yeah, completion percentage still around 50%, right? All the things we said, still not really a competent pass for the ball. Probably most importantly, though, Alan, and I want to conclude with Frank's thought on this, unless something drastic happens, he's not going to be a good enough runner of the football in Mullen's system to be dangerous. And that's why when I get into debates or discussions with people, you're dogging Franks. Don't you think Franks can turn a corner? Don't you think Franks can get to a top-level guy? Look at these guys who have developed. There's just a serious problem there with his current skill set and how Mullen wants to run things. He just doesn't get it done. If your quarterback in this kind of offense should have your highest yards per carry tally. It's the easiest to run it as a quarterback. And he's the lowest by far. He averages like 3.6 or something yards per carry. He's just not really a competent runner. And so that's why I say that's always going to hold him back, which, Alan, something to tee up right now for the rest of the season, something we'll revisit, I know. We have competent runners on the team. We have a guy in Kadarius Toney who's an extremely competent runner and has played some quarterback. I continue to be a little bit surprised that we have not put packages in where he is your smaller Tim Tebow, if you will, running those zone reads, because you really only need him to throw it once every 8 or 9 times just to prove he will, to get the same number advantages. We saw one last game, he's carried a couple times. Yeah, so but keep an eye on that, though, because Mullen, it's not lost on Mullen that Franks, although he's running, is not really being very effective. He's going to need a more effective run game as we play better teams. I think he knows that. Just keep an eye on that. I'm curious to see how we creatively address that if Franks is unable to improve that yard per carries number. All right, let's go quick look at the offensive ranks. We're in the quarter pole through the season. We kind of talked about where we thought we'd finish this year. These are very interesting numbers, Alan.
Strange
very
numbers.
Interesting. And points scored, we're 25th, which is great. Yards per play, 22nd, which is fantastic. Excellent. Points per play, 8th, which is extremely good, right? We're not running a lot of plays. We're scoring a ton of points. Problem with a lot of those numbers are they're not totally offensive dependent. Yards, we're 86. That's more indicative kind of where we are. Rush yards, 47th. Yards per rush, 11th. This is a huge improvement from what we've seen in previous years. A lot of this, though, of course, has to do with Pierce's final game carries. And then perhaps the most telling, yards per pass, we're 62nd, which is an improvement over last year. And passing yards, we're still 100th. We're really still averaging 170 or so passing yards a game. We're just not where we want to be. And the key stat of the year to me, Alan, is our turnover margin. So we're 4th. We're +2, which is huge in turnover margin. That's fantastic. And then in a stat that may or may not be concerning just yet because we played so many weird games, we're almost dead last in time of possession.
Yeah, I could see that for sure being something that could bite us. Now, again, in this game, short fields, but we did go 3 and out 3 times in a row in the second half, and that was the most frustrating part of the game for me, where we should have turned that game into a total laugher. We're playing all backups because we don't really need to expose our defense to any more pressure situations. I don't know. The totals sometimes are skewed, right? What is the tempo of the game? Sometimes you see defenses give up a lot of yardage because their offense has a ton of drive, so they're out there all the time. So don't land on any one of those things, but I think some encouraging things, some discouraging things. Is there one that sticks out to you as either most encouraging or discouraging?
I think the most encouraging thing is our rushing attack has improved. And we mentioned, I think, one of your pod questions after week 2 was, if we don't run the ball, we're kind of screwed, to put it simply. We have to put more into running the ball. We have improved running the ball, even if it's not against the best run defenses. And I want to note that. I don't expect us to tear up Mississippi State this weekend. But that's an improvement that is significant over last year. And we have a lot of the same exact players, right? So I think that's a marked improvement you're already seeing on offense. And that, to me, was something we expected to see under Mullen. And it's good to get what you expect in that regard. So the other stats are nicer. Turnover margin is amazing. But I think for me, we really highlighted the rushing attack. And it has come along. It is still not where you and I want it to be. But it's definitely improved. It's impossible to say it's not improved. It is improved. All right. Defensively, Alan, we had 5 turnovers and a safety in this game, which is a dream. It's fantastic, yeah. Right? Little Peyton celebrating every moment. Did the defense improve this week? It's weird to even ask this question. Did it improve from last week, or was Tennessee so bad on offense, which we highlighted in the intro to the game, they are absolutely awful on offense, that they were a downgrade in competition?
It was so interesting to watch them. They're so limited. They were still running the ball in second half down by a million. They don't trust Garantano to do anything. Now, he actually was coming to the game completing a really high percentage of his passes because they were throwing these little dinks and dunks in probably non-obvious situations. But when he had to drop back and pass, they had no hope of blocking us. And you saw that. He was getting crushed. Even though he made a couple throws down the field and they made some catches, he was getting murdered every time. It was a DeAndre Francois type of situation. So, but we still had to cause that pressure. If you're getting blocked by Tennessee, that's a bad look, and we weren't. But the biggest thing by far, our run defense, night and day from Kentucky. Now, there's probably a lot of reasons. Kentucky is excellent at running the ball. Benny Snell is a load. But having David Reese back, I expected it to do wonders. It was more than I could have hoped for. He was filling every gap that he needed to. Every time I'm like, who made that tackle? David Reese. So you can't, I don't know. I don't can't even like say how much of a difference is between the gap between him and Jackson. So it's not like just a normal player was in there, you know, kind of a replacement level player. It was that sub. And then going up to Reese, who's excellent at that particular function, getting us lined up, filling the gaps. I mean, stellar from him. So good to have him on the field.
And we said from the beginning that that was a guy we could not afford to lose. We did not have anyone near his ability. We still continue to say that we really don't have an SEC caliber set of linebackers. And what's really most fascinating, Alan, is when you ask if the defense improved, if you're going to say yes, it's because the personnel improved. Because it's hard to say anyone else really improved, although there were a lot of great plays being made. But David Reese's impact on the game was total. It was total. From the defensive line being able to get more pressure in their gaps, from the other linebackers being able to cover better because they were no longer worried about having to help on the run, from safeties being able to actually stay back as young guys, it was just a total influence by David Reese. We can ill afford to lose him. We know what that looks like. We know what it looks like with him. Phenomenal debut performance in the Dan Mullen era for David Reese. A couple other guys we should note here. Obviously, Polite had another great game. A guy that's continued to do well. And then Shuler, Alan, maybe he... I picked Slayton to be the breakout performer. He looks like he's fading into the sunset right now. Plenty of season left, but Shuler has become not only maybe the most productive defensive tackle, but now they're saying he's the leader of this group in the D-line.
Well, he's an older guy. He's played a lot of snaps at West Virginia. Maybe he just knows how to do it. And that's what we needed, somebody in that spot who was capable and could execute on what Grantham wants him to do. I'll also say, helping our run defense, C.C. Jefferson. So he's been doing the yeoman's work of setting the edge. Not spectacular on the stats, although I think, you know, maybe you could give him credit for the safety. I'm not sure. There's like five guys in on that. Combinations of the right people in the right places, plus David Reese, plus maybe learning a little bit more how to play in that system, how to play with effort and not just in your head. But yeah, all that together made for a much better run defense. And you got to go against Tennessee and their struggles. What else did you notice?
Well, Henderson continues to shine, right? When he was on Marquez Callaway was not in the game. And that guy is a very good receiver.
Granted,
terrible offensive line from Tennessee, not a good quarterback, but he's legit. Tennessee just quickly said, no more of this. Let's move him to the other side. And the way that the Gators play defense under Grantham is we don't follow guys around. So in previous years, you say, hey, your assignment's him. You just go where he goes. We don't do that. So then Callaway was able to draw our more inexperienced corners, Trey Dean, other guys that were in there. Yeah, Brad Edwards is in there. And it was very clear that they were not capable of guarding him. Now, you don't expect a freshman to be able to guard that kind of receiver normally. We've been very spoiled here at Florida where freshmen have been able to do that. It does show you the drop-off that we have. I mean, if all of a sudden Henderson goes down, I don't even want to think about what that looks like.
Wrap him in Reese in plastic, please. Like, just put them in a glass case and carry them around.
Yeah, he's just head and shoulders better than any other corner we have. And then a guy that we jumped on last week who had a really poor game, Brad Stewart, had maybe the game of his life out there. Doesn't show up in any negative plays. Tennessee didn't throw it a lot, but when they did throw it, he had a phenomenal pick over the top. Great coverage, great pick, and then he forced a fumble on special teams.
Good day by him.
Great day for Brad Stewart. Nice to see the safeties contributing. Overall, probably the best game from the safeties this season.
Tennessee was not stepping back and throwing it down the field, trying to split our safeties.
Correct. We're not challenged, but we'll take what we can get from that unit because we know it's not going to be.
No negatives is a positive.
Not going to be brilliant all year long. Okay, defensive ranks here, Alan. Quickly through these. Kind of what you expect here from the defensive side. So we're 27th in points allowed, which is solid. About 19 points a game is what we're allowing. Yards per play, 55th. Points per play, 26th, which is good. So teams aren't scoring, even though they are drawing us. They're not scoring. 58th in yards, 101st in rush yards. Not surprising when you gave up the fake rush yards that we did to Charleston Southern. Those really aren't real. But then we gave up a lot to Kentucky. Although it looks like, this might be safe to say, Alan, that Kentucky is one of the best rushing teams in the country.
Probably.
Maybe even the best rushing team in the Power Five. It's possible you can make the argument because everyone knows they're going to run and they're still doing it. So that remains to be seen. Probably most importantly on defense, our passing yards is a mirage to me. If you want to look at a stat that's fake, we're 45th in allowing passing yards. That's almost entirely a function of playing inferior pass competition. We're going to find out what we're made of later on when we face the Drew Locks of the world there. We're woeful on third down. We highlighted it coming into this game. We're better on this game. We're 117th on third down, which is incredibly, incredibly poor. Yet we have a ton of takeaways, which is incredibly good. Now, Grantham, it should be noted that the knock on Grantham is that he prefers to generate turnovers over stopping people on third down. It's the recurring head scratcher. It's something as Gator fans we should all get used to. Teams are probably going to convert on third down more than they should, but if things go well, he generates a ton of turnovers.
So his thought here would be, I'm going to give up maybe over the course of the game an extra 50 to 100 yards, but then we're going to have those plays where we're going to get points, and that's ultimately going to tell the story of the game, not did they pick up a few more third downs. Now, it's killed us, obviously, against Kentucky getting off the field, and they had huge plays on third down, burnt us. We can't have that. But I don't know. Right now, I'll take it. We'll see. You know, you'll take it until you don't want it anymore. Those stats aren't great, but still early. Still early.
So all in all, on the defensive side of the ball, on the offensive side of the ball, I think it's safe to say that there are some things we're doing maybe better than we thought. One, generating turnovers. Huge turnaround from last year, primarily with the same exact players. That's fantastic. That's all coaching, scheme-based, etc. And some other things that aren't so surprising to us, like our passing offense or even our passing defense, which we highlighted. But a lot remains to be seen. Just wanted to give you an idea of kind of where we stand. Special teams might, Alan, be the unit we could say is the most improved.
Oh, easily.
And when I say might, I mean 100% definitely. It's been really enjoyable to watch special teams be good again and make an impact on the game after suffering through the Greg Nord era. I'm going to highlight a couple of things that went on. The bad in this game, we were absolutely not ready for the onside kick by Tennessee. They scouted us. Pierce was already 20 yards off the line of scrimmage even before that kick was made. He was kicking it right into the gap, and P. Ryan makes an absolute hero grab amidst amazing five Tennessee players to save that moment. So good job there. I'm sure we'll clean that up, but just about everything else is positive. Townsend, while probably not as good as his brother Johnny at hitting the ball deep,
especially at this point,
has proven to be absolutely fantastic at the end-over-end punt deep down inside. We executed one that we actually caught on the 2-yard line, Cleveland, which is phenomenal execution by Cleveland. Then we wind up getting stripped by Brad Stewart in the second half opening kickoff, which is fantastic. And we've looked completely competent in other phases of the game. McPherson continues to be an excellent field goal kicker. So far, special teams has made a big difference, a big, big difference. And we needed that. We said that in the beginning of the year. This unit has got to be good with the kind of team we have, and they have been good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that continues because that will, if you want to talk about variance and victories, like what our win share expectation will be, if you're getting that many pluses in special teams, you're going to come out on the plus side of that. And so if we want to see the higher end version of our wins, like those guys continue to play well, having guys like Tyree Cleveland on special teams, I mean, that's huge. So Mullen obviously values it. He's talked a lot about if the head coach doesn't value it, these guys won't, because they weren't recruited to play special teams for the most part. And that's been a big plus for us this year. I want to give them credit for that.
All right, a couple final thoughts before we put this Tennessee game to bed. We can see the team is improving each week, Alan. And my final thought is this is a sign of good coaching. And we tipped at this earlier. As a sad byproduct of this, I have not got to have as many really fun game theory discussions on play calling or failed coaching decisions conversations either. Those are really fun as a podcaster, but I'm very happy as a fan not to have done that. Don't worry if you love the game theory segments. Those are going to occur when we get into more competitive games. Oddly enough, everything has been pretty straightforward decision-making at this point in time. Haven't had a whole lot to get into. Maybe minus, Alan, the passing rut, if you will, we got into against Kentucky where we kind of abandoned the run, even though we didn't have the numbers, which we lightly touched on. Outside of that, been pretty normal. But hands down, what we expect out of Dan Mullen, he has been doing. This team is actually getting better. You can see the progress each and every week. I fully expect this team to continue to get better. I don't know what the record's going to be, Alan. I think both of those things can happen at the same time. We could win 7 games and I could still say this team improved. We could win 9 games and I could still say this team improved. The record is going to be what it is. But so far, you take a hard loss at home to Kentucky and you follow it up with 2 wins that where you demolish your opponents. And now 3 of our first 4 wins, Alan, we scored more than 45 points in. I can't tell you the last time that's happened.
No, it's like you have to look pretty far back to see that. Yeah, it's hard. That Kentucky win really, or loss, excuse me, really taints a lot of the conversation there. I don't know. We'll have to figure out, again, going forward, what we think about that. The game will look, we'll have a lot more clarity on that game as we move into the future.
And how much, then, can we take away from not only this crazy game, but also the Colorado State crazy game? Can we take anything from this? Does this give you anything? What insight do you have?
It's hard to contextualize this, but we're getting way less film on us on offense, which is, I think, where the primary concerns are, you know, in terms of us reaching the high end. I think the defense will get to a place where we feel okay about them. Seems like we're moving in that direction, especially, you know, getting our personnel back together. I'm tempted to be much more positive heading into this Mississippi State game than I thought I would be 2 weeks ago. I'm trying not to let the chaos of this now, because you can win games by mirages, but let's say we see Alabama have a similar game against somebody. You'd be like, Alabama's so much better. They just freaking wiped the floor. They took the ball away from them. You go, yeah, that's what I would think, that they would freaking just stub them out. Now, can you not make the same translation to the Gators? You can, but you want to be careful doing that. We don't have a history of doing that in the same way that Alabama has. And we're not always road grading people. When we're not taking the ball away, we're giving up yards. Like, you know, you watch Alabama play Ole Miss. They give a big play, first play of the game, but then they basically grind them to a halt. And we're obviously nowhere near. Comparing yourself to Alabama is always a fool's errand anyway. But I don't want to just totally dismiss these turnovers and this gameplay as nothing. How are you feeling about it?
I think that is the takeaway, is don't dismiss this. This is not on accident. These are not the Will Muschamp wins where we lucked ourselves into an 11-win season by scraping by every single game. The meta narrative on Dan Mullen, according to yours truly, is that he crushes the inferior teams. Now, I thought Kentucky was an inferior team during that week and predicted a big win. It's clear at this point in time that Kentucky is not the team that I thought they were. Based upon the film they put out in one game, they're definitely much better than that. We don't know how good they are, but they're absolutely not an inferior team to Florida this season. And we expected, like we said in the beginning of the season, I picked 7 wins because those are coin flips. And that wound up being a coin flip game. So if anything, I take a lot of comfort from saying, okay, you know what? We have crushed the teams we're better than. Now, what do we do this weekend with a team that's probably better than us? We're going to find out. Should be interesting. Before that, I'll run through the national games, Alan. You take the SEC games. A lot of interesting stuff happened last weekend. FAU played a close one for a while with UCF, and then UCF pounded them. Is UCF the real deal?
I don't want to say so, but maybe. I've gotten annoyed with them. It's their, you know, maybe it's all the national championship stuff. I haven't got to watch them play. I just see the results. They're interesting. I don't know that there's going to be a team on their schedule that'll challenge them the way that I want them to. We'll have to see if they can keep this pace, but they're putting up a ton of points. Obviously, everyone's going to against FAU, but that's a good win for them.
Yeah, keep an eye out right now. It's hard to deny them. I know they're calling themselves national champions, and they're frustrating pretty much everyone in the college football community, but might not be a bad political play by them, because if they go undefeated this year, maybe much harder to keep them out of some sort of dance, depending on what goes
yeah,
down.
Yeah, well, I would. Yeah, let them play Alabama.
Yeah,
we'll see how that goes.
I'd love to see it. Northern Illinois 19. This game was much closer than the score indicates. Florida State 37.
There was a moment FSU was up by 10. Northern Illinois had the ball in their territory. They don't score. FSU, you know, has a long play touchdown. Good result for FSU. They beat Northern Illinois, probably prevents them from having the kind of catastrophic year that would maybe even get a coach fired like a couple games into the season next year. So they're going to have to earn everyone on their schedule except for maybe one more moving forward. So we'll talk about them every week. They're fascinating in that they're so bad. We'll see if they can pull themselves out of the basement.
Yeah, it's hard to create a positive narrative for Florida State. They looked just as bad as they have in every other game. This was not all that different from the Samford game, only that they squeaked it out there at the end a little bit more comfortably. Georgia, surprising result here for me. This is my lock of the week. 14-point favorite. We get a push, 43-29. Multiple points in this game. It looked like Georgia was going to run away with it. After the game, Kirby Smart was extremely displeased with his team's effort. Felt like it was sloppy, lacked detail, lacked a finishing spirit. I took away from this, Alan, that Missouri looks good. And I know I picked them to beat us this season. I picked them to actually be good. They look good to me.
Yeah, I'll have to say that my preseason prediction of them fading away and that they were mirage last year looks like it's not going to be true, unfortunately, for the Gators. Mizzou is a weird place to play. We've had players talk about that. You know, Drew Locke said, you know, screw you and your lock here of the week. I guess Georgia's at a place where a win of this magnitude is disappointing. It's still a good win on the road. I mean, Kirby Smart's doing the Saban thing where he's, you know, I'm disappointed with that, you know, unless we're at perfection, which even if we were at perfection, I would make up some things for us to be, you know, not perfect in. But yeah, both those games will look real tough on our schedule. Not looking forward to those necessarily, but it will be really interesting when we get there.
Michigan. 56. Scott Frost and Nebraska, 10. Wendy's after the game put out a tweet.
Wendy's coming for people.
Wendy's is trolling people, mentioning that maybe they need a Scott Frosty to ease the pain. This is rough. This is an 18-point favorite game. You and I kind of waffled a little bit. Michigan hasn't scored well. Michigan beat them like a drum. I mean, is Scott Frost not just thinking, why? Why did I leave? I mean, what is happening here, Alan?
This is tough. Because, you know, you look at the first few games that Nebraska played, they could have won. They're missing their quarterback. They look further away from where they want to be after this game. They don't look like they're moving forward at the pace that Nebraska fans are hoping for. Now, again, you know, Scott Frost, I think, is still a great hire. This doesn't change that, getting pants by Michigan, who's a very talented team. And the type of team, if they're better than you, they're going to abuse you. And Nebraska got abused.
A&M 23, Bama 45. Jimbo Fisher says, do not make me a 26.5-point favorite. I don't deserve that. He sneaks in there, gets a moral victory against the handicappers. This game was a good game for a while. And I think my narrative here, Alan, was that I felt like Bama played good, and I felt like A&M played extremely well, given the circumstances, and they got throttled. And you're just like, is Bama just this much better than everyone that I kind of feel like A&M did well and they're down 3 to 4 scores most of the game?
Short answer, yes.
That's the right answer.
Okay.
And Bama is just a scary, scary juggernaut. Kansas State 6, seemingly finding their way into our national game recap every week. West Virginia 35, a kind of ho-hum win for Will Grier. 5 touchdowns, 2 picks. My boy lights it up. But West Virginia narrative here is their defense actually, and Kansas State's offense is terrible, their defense seems to be competent, which could be huge for them.
Well, they're not letting teams like Tennessee and Kansas State put points on the board and stress them. Like, they don't have to win every game in a shootout, which seemed like that was the, you know, it's normally the way West Virginia wins games. So that's good. That's a good news for them, even though, yeah, like, it's a ho-hum game. But maybe if you're West Virginia, you want some ho-hum games because you're about to go through the ringer here, Texas Tech, Oklahoma State. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, we'll see what they're made of. Texas takes down TCU. TCU, emotional game at Ohio State, loses to Texas. We had said on this very pod, not worried about Tom Herman. The guy's going in the right direction. It's a 3-year test. This is year 2. That's a big win for Texas.
Yeah, huge. And this is one of those games, TCU, if you're like buying or selling stock, I wouldn't sell all your TCU stock. You come off an emotional game against Ohio State where you're probably circling that on your calendar. You're mentally abused, you're physically beat up, and then you got to go play a hungry Texas team. But it's good news for Texas. I think better news for Texas than it is like worse news. It's not, I don't think TCU is a fraud. That was a tough spot to play Texas in.
Game of the week, entertainment-wise, wow, without a doubt. Stanford 38, Oregon 31, finished in overtime. If you didn't see it, if you did not see it, Oregon has the ball, second down and three, essentially running the clock out. A first down guarantees the game is over, but they actually could have just taken a kneel down and left Stanford with like 5 seconds left on their own five-yard line. They had that option. Gets the first down, fumbles while being tackled. Stanford gets the ball, scores. They go to overtime. Stanford wins. This is a soul-crushing loss for Oregon, who looked like the better team all game long.
I think they were. I mean, there was a moment that Oregon was going to go up. Were they going to go up 31-7, I think. This is the pylon play where he kicks the pylon. He's short. I think it was the correct call. And then they fumble the snap, and Stanford scoops and scores going the other way. So that was a 14-point swing. They, you know, if the call doesn't get reversed or they just handle the snap, the game is over. Man, that if I was an Oregon fan, I would just feel so crushed. I mean, that's a team that you have a tough time against anyway. You're going to freaking put it on them. And now Stanford is set up. If they pick up some more wins, they might get in the playoff. And that wasn't happening, you know, halfway through the game. They survived like every moment of that game and pulled out. So gritty performance by them that they didn't give up.
Speaking of surviving, a true shocker, Oklahoma and Army, yeah, duking it out into overtime to where Oklahoma pulls a victory.
I mean, you look at the time of possession, Army had the ball the entire game. They're a weird team to play, but Oklahoma's so much better than them. I don't know really. There's a game every year where a team that's still really great has a weird results. You know, Florida Ole Miss, 2008, whatever. Things happen. You look at the NFL this week, weird stuff happens. Sometimes stuff happens, but Oklahoma lucky to get out of there with a win.
That's kind of the highlight of college football, right? Is that football is the beauty of it is how unpredictable it is. And you know, if this were an NFL podcast, we would have weeks to discuss what went down on Sunday. It was absolute mayhem. But that's what makes the sport so great, and the theater is so compelling, because a team like Virginia Tech plays on the road, by the way, on the road at Old Dominion, which first of all is incredibly weird to have an in-state game like that. And more weird is that they lose. Not really fluky either. Old Dominion just goes up and down the field on them.
Old Dominion had gotten spanked by Liberty and teams like that already this year. They were 0-3. This wasn't an Old Dominion team that was 3-0 and like a Troy-type team. You're like, oh, man, they got you. They cut your throat. Shocking from Virginia Tech. Now, they lost their starting quarterback at some point in the game, but still, that was so weird. There's not good things going on in Blacksburg. They had a lot of trouble in the offseason. We thought maybe, hey, look how good they are. Look how they're punking Florida State. But that might just been a reflection of how poor Florida State is, unless that Virginia Tech had their stuff together.
And Fuente is a hire we liked. Mm-hmm. And has seemingly been doing good things. Doesn't mean he isn't, but this is a very questionable loss. Keep an eye on what's going on there in Blacksburg.
ACC in general there had a Big Ten type weekend this week. All right, let's do SEC roundup. Kent State 17, Ole Miss 38. This game was pretty close for a while.
Yeah, low scoring by Ole Miss. I'm not sure if Kent State was able to model what Alabama did at some low level, and they kind of got a little game plan on them.
Or does Ole Miss just get their body and spirit broken?
Also that. We'll find out.
South Carolina 37, Vandy 14. Now, this might be another case where Vandy is coming off a really tough loss and they get punched in the mouth by South Carolina.
This is a good win by South Carolina. You know, South Carolina gets their whole season essentially ended by Georgia. Like, however good you thought you were, whatever preseason mags you were reading, you got obliterated. And now you have to keep playing your schedule and you have to play hard. And Vandy is a team that is licking their wounds. But Vandy's feeling good. They're feeling as good as they've ever felt after that Notre Dame game, psychologically. And then, you know, South Carolina crushes you at home. That's a bad look for Vandy. I mean, once again, Vandy just leaves you with sort of this.
Well, I think that's where you're at with a team like Vandy. I mean, it's hard to be consistent week in and week out with that kind of talent and coaching staff. College players are notoriously up and down. And this, I probably should have expected this, honestly. Louisiana Tech 21, LSU 38. This one was closer to than it looks from the end.
This just feels like an Ed Orgeron win. For all the people out there that write us a lot about Ed Orgeron, This is what you get with that Orgeron. This is why I feel like I don't know what to do with LSU. They still don't feel great to me. They feel like they're just surviving. But
two of the best wins in the country, though, Miami.
Yeah, they do. They have them. Those are there, and they're fantastic. And I'm not taking anything away from it. Auburn looks maybe weaker than we thought, but it doesn't even matter. It's whoever they play, you feel like it's going to be close for a while. And that's a little bit less Miles-ish right now with the way Ed Orgeron is, but keep an eye on what's going on there. They're winning. They're rolling. Certainly, this is a great season for them thus far, but I still am not totally sure.
We'll put them under more of a microscope in a couple weeks. Arkansas 3, Auburn 34.
This is not a good showing for Auburn. There's a lot of concern, as there always is, in Auburn over Gus Malzahn and now Jared Stidham and the play calling and what's going on. And maybe Arkansas got a little better on defense over the week. I doubt it. I think Auburn is reeling. Huge expectations this year. And it looks like there's no way they're going to even come close to fulfilling any of them.
Yeah, they're either clicking on offense or they're not. And they seem to be stumbling right now. It really does seem to be the lack of a premier running back is holding them back. I mean, it's weird to say that at a major college. It's like you can't find a running back to fit your system. They had a lot of attrition at that position. It's catching up to them, I think. All right. Our opponent this week, Mississippi State Bulldogs 7, Kentucky Wildcats 28. Wow.
Watching the film, I'm just shaking my head. Watching the film on this game, it was such an interesting game.
This was close, too, for much of it.
Mississippi State goes up 7-0. It looks like for a long time, Mississippi State's going to go up 14-0. Not because their offense looks good, but because Kentucky seemingly can't do anything for a long stretch of the game. And then it's 7-7, and it's 14-7 going into the fourth quarter, and then it's a Benny Snell long touchdown run. It's 21-7. You know the game is kind of over. Mississippi State last year with Dan Mullen beat Kentucky 45-7. And then Kentucky beats them 28-7. Almost, Alan, the same exact personnel across the board for both teams. Both of these teams returned quite a few starters. I mean, almost all of their roster. This is as perplexing as the result as you can get. There's a lot of questions that come out of this one, and I want to ask you the most important one. Does Kentucky's performance against the Bulldogs make you reevaluate our performance against Kentucky?
Yes, definitely. It's so frustrating to watch Kentucky run the ball on us, and they ran the ball too, and they wore Mississippi State's front down. They got better in the fourth quarter. I always make a joke about Kentucky. You know, they're always turning the corner. They're just going in a big circle. They might have actually turned some sort of corner that Terry Wilson makes them dangerous enough. Him running the ball or Benny Snell running the ball, their offensive line is competitive and fire enough that they're very difficult to contain. So yes, I mean, it makes me question a lot of things. Now, you're big Moorhead. I've always I want to hold back on Mississippi State. Show me that you can do this in this offense. And so that wasn't surprising to me that they weren't lighting it up on offense, although they had put up a lot of points. It definitely causes me to reevaluate both us and Kentucky.
And Mississippi State at this point in time. But Kentucky clearly looks like they're going to be good. It makes a potential Kentucky-Missouri and a Kentucky-South Carolina game very interesting.
Well, right now they're the second best SEC East team by far because they have a win over us and a win against Mississippi State. So, I mean, they've got to still play the other teams on their schedule. But right now, if you were going to say who's the consensus second best team in the SEC East, it would be Kentucky.
Yeah, I suppose if you're not looking at actual matchups or what may happen, what they've done thus far would indicate that. Yeah, I still don't think they'll finish that way. But regardless, they are not the Kentucky we thought they were. They're definitely not. Absolutely not. Safe to say it's the case. Okay, so let's take just a minute or two here to thank some more patrons. Appreciate you guys so much. This first one has got a funky character. I'm not even sure it came out correctly, but Robert asked by with an N-Y-A in between something over nothing. It's hard to know what that is. Appreciate your support. Kyle Moore. What's up, Kyle? Thanks so much for the support. Jeremy Bloor. Joseph Pecoraro? One of those or other. Then my boy Jeff Tillman. Man, Jeff Tillman, dude, thanks so much for the support. I didn't even go to UF, I know, but lived in Gainesville. Good man. Then Guillermo Diaz.
Yeah.
The one, the only, the co-founder of my investment firm with me, giving us some support. Dono. And then Dimitri. Thanks, Dimitri, man. Appreciate what that. Up? So, yeah, an all-star list of people we're thanking. As always, you can find us on Patreon and become a patron. in any of the links that we share, Facebook, Twitter, etc. Simple click, a few clicks later, you too can get a shout out on this podcast.
Coveted shout out. All right, let's look at Mississippi State. They're 3-1. They're a 7-point favorite over us. Obviously, there's a lot of familiarity coming into this game, mostly coming from our end. But I guess it works both ways. Our coaches know their players intimately. Their defense is used to having been up against this style and scheme of offense. So even if the coaches don't always know, the players do. So, James, do you think that that familiarity is going to pay big dividends or not that much dividends?
I think it pays big dividends. I can think of my own playing experiences in sports, even in the flag football field. If you play against a team that knows why you're doing what you're doing, and Dan Mullen is a coach that teaches the why on both sides of the ball, they understand your theory. They know what you want to attack primarily.
So when you make a move, even if it's misdirection, you know why the misdirection
works. You know why it's occurring. And so, you know, Bill Belichick's philosophy in football, which is not working out so well this year, thankfully, I'm enjoying that, is to take away what teams want to do. And most teams actually, even on film, have a hard time teaching their players in 1 week what teams want to do effectively enough to stop it. So all of these defenders on Mississippi State, of which seven are returners, they know exactly what Dan Mullen wants to attack. And Felipe Franks, you could argue, is just a slightly different, or maybe significantly different than the running end, but slightly different version of Nick Fitzgerald. They both have huge arms. They both are not guys that complete a lot of passes. They're prone to making some mistakes.
Big plays and inaccurate.
Right. And so there's a lot of similarities there. Of course, doesn't run as well, so it should be easier for them to stop them. But I think that in these situations, the advantage still goes to the coach. The advantage goes to the coach. So Dan Mullen, I think, Alan, has a bigger advantage than his defensive players do seeing the offense, because he knows every single one of those players' actual weaknesses. What can't they cover? What would I do to attack them? Things that other coaches never know because he sees it in practice. So I think the advantage goes to the coach, but without a doubt, that defense will be very comfortable going against our offense. And I'm sure it's causing concern for Dan Mullen and the staff.
Yeah, they're going to have to think critically about how do we – they know what our tendencies are. How do we confuse them even more? One step of misdirection is not going to work. All right, so a little overview. We've talked about their head coach a bunch. Joe Moorhead, his first year there, coming over from Penn State. Luke Getsy's their offensive coordinator, but he's largely a figurehead or an assistant, essentially, because Joe Moorhead's the one calling the plays. Bob Shoup, first year there, obviously, you should recognize that name from Tennessee, Penn State, and Vandy. A lot of returning starters, 16 on offense, 7 on defense. And if you're interested in this type of thing, you know, their 5-year recruiting ranking is 27th. But this has been the hallmark of Dan Mullen, is he takes guys who are 3-star guys and turns them into 4-star guys. So still some high-level talent on this team. You'll hear names like Jeffrey Simmons and Montez Sweat. They have some good running backs. And obviously Nick Fitzgerald is a guy who, you know, not very highly recruited and had a ton of success. Big athletic guy. James, when you watch them, what did you pick up on the film analysis?
So philosophically, a Joe Moorhead offense, you might wonder, how does that differ from a Dan Mullen offense? Isn't it a spread offense? Don't they run the ball a lot? Aren't they pretty balanced? Yes, but there are a couple of significant derivations, which is why this current Mississippi State team, A, struggled against Kentucky, and B, is in fact entirely different philosophy-wise. As even Dan Mullen described it today in the presser, it is an entirely different offense. And so let's clean up some of that confusion. So they like to run out of 11 personnel, which very simply is one tight end, one running back, and 3 wide receivers. A lot of teams run out of 11 personnel. If I were to give you what personnel groupings are most frequent in college football, it's 11 personnel. The difference with the Joe Moorhead offense is they stay in it more than 90% of the time. And the reason they do that is they do not want your defense to be able to key on their personnel and make a decision as to whether they're running or they're passing or they're spreading you out or whatever the case may be. And so you send in your defenders to counter that kind of personnel. Maybe you're in the nickel, and then they come out in one of a million different formations, which puts a lot of pressure on your defenders to be able to handle that. So in a college practice each week, you may work with your guys to say, okay, look, here's my run-stopping package on 3rd and 4, and here's my pass package on 1st and 10. You do not get that luxury against the Joe Moorhead offense. You do not get that luxury. So when things are working really well, and you have Saquon Barkley, and you have Trace McSorley, you can score a lot of points. The primary derivation from Joe Moorhead to Dan Mullen is Joe Moorhead puts a huge emphasis on big plays. It is absolutely a part of his strategic game plan, whereas Dan Mullen almost exclusively does not. To give this example, Mississippi State was almost always near the bottom of explosive plays. They had moments where they'd be better with a Dak Prescott and et cetera. But last year, they were near the bottom in explosive plays. And one of Joe Moorhead's number one offseason goals is we have got to create more explosive plays. He views these as the cheat code in football. If you can score on one play, it's a huge way to demoralize your opponent and steal points, right? They have not been very successful with this year. Even when they're scoring, it's been a struggle for them. And that is almost entirely because Nick Fitzgerald is not an accurate passer. So the difference between Trace McSorley and Nick Fitzgerald is passing. McSorley, very accurate. Fitzgerald, very not accurate, right? Very inaccurate. And that's caused a significant issue. Lastly, teams started to figure out towards the end of his tenure at Penn State that the best way to play a guy who wants to create a lot of big plays is not to give him a lot of big plays. Therefore, they play a lot of cover two deep. That is precisely what Kentucky did the entire game against Mississippi State. They stayed way back in that deep cover two shell. They forced him to make underneath throws he did not want to make, and they blitzed the absolute heck out of him. Now, we can copy Kentucky's game plan exactly. The difference is we do not have experienced safeties like Kentucky has, which is a big, big deal, right? And our linebacking core, of course, is not filled with NFL athletes like Kentucky has. They have two guys that are probably going to play in the league on that linebacking core. But we can take one major thing. So how will UF counter this kind of multiple offense that expects to run the run-pass option, wants to hit us deep, wants to be able to score big plays through the run or the pass? I fully expect us to run our base defense, which is the 3-4 cover two nickel, Allen, and I fully expect us to attempt to make them drive the ball down the field. Now, the biggest question mark, which is the most obvious question to ask here, is Kentucky dominated Mississippi State's offensive line. This was an experienced offensive line that played extremely well last year, only gave up 7 sacks the whole season. This year, they've already given up 5, and Fitzgerald has been under pressure on half of his dropbacks. He's been under pressure. They are really, really struggling. There's plenty of reason to believe that we could have some success with our natural defense, aggressive, blitzing, 3-4. There's reason to believe we can put pressure on Nick Fitzgerald, and there's plenty of reason to believe, Allen, that Nick Fitzgerald is not a good enough thrower of the ball to make you pay for that if you can stay sound. So the matchup on film is really, really interesting, their offense versus our defense. It's something I'm looking forward to. I know that you've watched Mississippi State play, Allen. What are some of your takeaways from what you saw on Kentucky coming into what you've seen with Florida's defense?
So you're right about Mississippi State being stymied. Like, they just seem like they can't execute the simple things. Fitzgerald is a guy who will make spectacular plays and then kind of fluff the easy stuff. I mean, like you said, kind of similar to Franks. He's so dynamic running the ball. If we get out of position, if we don't set the edge, if we don't fill the gaps, he's going to burn us. Now, we had some plays against Terry Wilson where he's a different kind of runner, but he murdered us coming out of the pocket. I could see them looking at that and saying, Fitzgerald, every time they lose contain, just go. Especially with some of the RPO, and Joe Moorhead runs real RPO stuff, or at least wants to. Our safeties, like you said, could get totally burnt. I don't know what to think about them. They looked lost against Kentucky a lot of times. Kentucky completely stymied them. Completely. And they were working from bad field position a lot of times, but that was a rough game. It could have just been a rough game for them, but if we're able to even come close to doing what Kentucky did against them, that will be huge for us, and I think we'll win the game. But that's a big, big if.
Yeah, huge if. This team, Allen, this defensive unit has struggled now for the better part of 2 or 3 years stopping a running quarterback. This personnel grouping we've seen, I would go as far as to say they have not done it. They have not done it. So this presents a very scary challenge to have the best running quarterback not named Tim Tebow, and Fitzgerald may break Tim Tebow's SEC rushing yards record, coming at you at home this weekend.
Were you surprised that Fitzgerald wasn't getting loose against Kentucky? Were you surprised that they didn't call more QB runs, like designed runs?
Well, I think it's like what we said about our own team. If we can't run the ball, we're dead. And Moorhead is different from Mullen in that in years he'll throw the ball a lot more. And I know Mullen will too. Don't get me wrong, Tyler. I know you're listening out there and you're yelling at the screen right now or yelling at whatever you're listening to. No, we throw it. He's throwing it with Prescott. He throws it before. Yes, I get that. Moorhead probably leans more towards wanting to throw it. Part of the problem they're having is they can't. Moorhead, after the game, said straight up, with this offense, if we can't run the ball, we know that we're dead. And I think they tried every way they could to get early first and second down runs, and they were routinely losing yards. I mean, Kentucky was eating them up in that game. I do not think we have the same ability to do so because we just do not have NFL linebackers that are able to fill those holes, rush those gaps. But the key to this game, without a doubt, and I'm jumping ahead here for my key to the game, is the line of scrimmage battle on first and second down. Because Mississippi State is not going to convert third and 10 on you. This is not going to happen. But if you give them third and 3, we are absolutely dead. Because that's when those run-pass options kill you. They steal easy points. They score touchdowns on you. They're dynamic. So this is just such an intriguing game. It's in a way unfortunate for us, Alan, that Mississippi State lost a game like this. They have so much tape on what they struggled with to improve with. And we run almost the same exact defense that Kentucky's going to run in this game. So it's just a lot of... I'm really excited to watch this happen. I have no clue how it's going to play out on the offensive-defensive side. And if you're talking about talent or experience, you can view Mississippi State as a team that's just a little bit better than us basically everywhere. And they're more experienced. It's a fair narrative. In fact, I think there's a tip here that's interesting, Alan. 7 points is too small of a spread, seemingly. If you asked us before this season what the spread should be, I don't think 7 would have been the number we would have thrown out there. So Vegas is also really confused as to sort of how this Joe Moorhead team is going to perform. I think people are recognizing that this is less of a schematic fit for him than they thought. He really does want a... He's a brilliant quarterback in his own right, but he's a passing quarterback in his mind. I think he's probably having a little bit of a tricky time working with a guy like Nick Fitzgerald, whereas Mullen is probably far better suited, right, to make that scenario, to make that switch. And I think we're seeing that, and it's early in their curve and their stage. Who knows when maybe the light bulb goes off? But a lot of really, really interesting matchups this week.
Do you think if this were allowed... If Mullen called Joe Moorhead and he said, I'll trade you Felipe Franks for Fitzgerald, either straight up or maybe you can throw in a running back or something like that, do you think they both would sign off on that?
That's a phenomenal question. I think Moorhead would have to spend time with Franks. But if my thesis on the fact that Franks is probably not that cerebral, I don't think so. I think he would like Franks' arm better than he likes Fitzgerald's because it is more accurate for sure. He's more of a pure thrower. But it's no secret that Moorhead favors smart quarterbacks.
I mean, that's McSorley is, I don't want to say he's not talented. He's extremely talented. He's just not physically gifted in the way you want. He's not big, I guess is what I'll say. But big arm, accurate, heady guy, willing, and deceptive runner. He's white, so I don't want to say deceptive from that. That's too much of a cliche. But the guy has wheels. Fitzgerald is very and this is why he was a little bit limited coming out of high school. I mean, he's going to run the ball. And he's incredibly fast and big. And if you can't stop him, he's going to just run all over the field on you. But he's a little one-dimensional. And we thought maybe that he had turned a corner under Joe Moorhead. He's going to be more dynamic. Like you said, maybe the fit isn't exactly what they wanted. I don't know. It's creating a little bit of uncertainty where we thought people were picking Mississippi State to be a top 10 team to go, toe-to-toe with Alabama. I wasn't ready to say that yet. We'll see whether that Kentucky game was a blip or that's more what they're like going forward.
And on a side note, had the Kentucky game lessened my love for Joe Moorhead anymore? No, it hasn't. He's still recruiting really well. I think that, I've said even from the beginning, the big question mark was this is not a good fit for how he wants to run offense. And let me just contextualize it by this. When you're a play caller, your goal is to have the quarterback be an extension of you on the field. You pretend you're wearing the helmet and you're playing, and what you see is what you want him to see. And the best coaches, like a Moorhead or like a Mullen or like any one of those guys, like a Lane Kiffin that are good offensive guys, they tailor it towards the guy. But there's a human element here. We all see things a little bit differently when it comes to a game. There's preferences we have. There's things we notice faster. It's very, very hard if Joe Moorhead notices certain things in the reverse order that Nick Fitzgerald may naturally recognize them. And that's why you've heard me say on this pod, my main contention with a Dan Mullen offense is it's just totally opposite of I would want to process attacking a defense as myself as a quarterback. And I think Moorhead's the same way. So keep an eye on that. This is probably the most intriguing, I think, game we're going to play all year long when it comes to just philosophy.
And they're new to us as well.
Because they're new to us. There's similarities here. It's the fact that Mullen coached there. He knows the players. So many interesting storylines in this game to watch for. On the defensive side of the ball, much more simple. Interesting storylines here. They do not run a 3-4 anymore. They run a 4-3. So Bob Shoup's a huge 4-3 guy. Like anyone else, they run a nickel. And I don't want to get too deep in the weeds of this, so I'll leave you with another Bill Belichick comment. But the reality of modern football with spread offenses is whether you run a 3-4 or a 4-3, almost everyone is running nickel. So in reality, it's a pretty small change. Like we mentioned, 3-4 is kind of the soup du jour in college football because it's more confusing for quarterbacks to pick up. But in reality, it's not that different. It's nickel versus nickel. However, it is 4-3. They are aggressive. They want to play kind of a lot like really a Jeff Collins would have done back in our former defensive Collins days, like the blitz a lot. Shoup is extremely familiar with our personnel, having played us twice at Tennessee. He did a good job against us last season, but again, our offense is now entirely different. He has not matched up with Mullen too often in his time, but he has. And then lastly, Alan, I think when you talk about Mississippi State's defense versus our offense, the conversation starts and ends at their D-line. Widely regarded as the second best D-line to Clemson. They're absolutely fantastic. They manhandled Kentucky for the majority of that game. And those yards wound up inflating to above 225, but that's almost all fourth quarter yardage. They did a phenomenal job shutting down Kentucky. That game was a game because of the defense. I expect them to be fantastic at home on Saturday. And I think they're looking at our offense and thinking we could put up a really nice day here. So a lot will be put on our offensive line in this game. We're going to find out, Alan, if we truly have made improvements in the past couple of weeks or not.
Just a quick note on penalties. Feels like we're hoping they would get cleaned up. They never get cleaned up. James, do you feel like this is a Florida thing, that no matter who our coach is, we're going to be one of the most penalized teams in the country? Do referees see that orange and blue and throw a flag? I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist kind of person, but what's up?
It feels that way at this point in time. Here's one caveat to that, though, Alan. We know Mississippi State last year did not commit a lot of penalties. And Mississippi State this year is worse than we are. We're about 100th. They're 110th. They had 16 penalties in that Kentucky game. 16. And they were still in the game all the way until the end. So we're right now averaging 8 a game. They're averaging 10 a game. It's way too many. It's possible that we're actually going to see this go lower with the Mullen team, as teams typically do this. But I don't know, Alan, if maybe it's just outside of Alabama, because Nick Saban's a freak, if it's just an elite athlete at a big program problem. These kids are younger. You heard Dan Mullen in the press conference say today, nobody wants to get developed. They want to play right away. And a symptom of inexperience is mistakes, period. In any profession, whatever profession you're in right now, if you're a student or you're working, in your profession, if you're inexperienced, you'll make more mistakes, period. And I think that may be what the difference is. Whereas at Mississippi State, Dan Mullen had more veteran players he developed for a long time. They weren't as quite as heralded. But certainly Florida has, whoever's coaching, has the worst, or amongst the worst in penalties every single year.
And I think it's a new coach thing, too. Players are adjusting. They're schematically, they're more prone to, inexperience in the new system. So keep an eye on that going throughout this game. Who has more penalties will be interesting. Okay, injuries. Dan Mullen didn't really give an injury update. Even if he does, he doesn't really say much. We seem like we got most of our guys back, except for Sean Davis didn't play in this game. So I guess he's still questionable. Jacob Copeland, our star, wide receiver, recruit. They're not even talking about him. Who knows when he's coming back? We'll just leave that alone for a while. Okay, let's get down to the prediction, the keys to victory. James, you already gave us one. Give us another one.
Penalties feel like they could matter in this game if it stays close. Here's how I see this game, like statistically. I think there's probably a 30% chance that Mississippi State crushes us. There's a 30% chance that Mississippi State wins by like 7-14. There's probably, 40% left, right? There's a 20% chance that the game is like a 3-point game either way, and there's a 20% chance that we win by like a touchdown. I don't even know.
No percentage chance that we blow them out?
I don't think so. I don't think they're that kind of team. They're too experienced. They're too veteran. I just don't think we have that. I don't see it. They don't make mistakes like that. Even the penalties they make, they're not turning the ball over 10 times. But I could be wrong. But maybe you assign some small percentage to it, right? But it seems in the anomaly category. So if I look at it that way, I say this is a 7-point line, but in reality, probability-wise, it's like a significant shift towards Mississippi State winning this game outright on the confidence level. So that means we have to pull an actual upset on the road, which is a fun place to be as a fan. I think there's narratives that I could create for that to happen. And I'm going to give you an actual set of keys to victory and then give you, of course, the prediction. In order for us to win this game, Alan, this is another cliche answer, but it's true. We're going to have to stop primarily the quarterback run, because the run pass option feeds more off the quarterback run than does anything else. That's number one, most important. So if we can hold Nick Fitzgerald to 50 yards or less, we've done our job. Any more than that, we're probably not winning this game. It's hard to conjure up a way to win that. And secondly, we're going to have to not allow breakdowns in the secondary that lead to easy points. We just cannot score enough points against Mississippi State's defense to win this game. We're going to have to win this game in a low-scoring affair. So I'm going to go with holding Nick Fitzgerald to 50 yards or less and keeping this game a low-scoring game. Those are my two keys to victory if Florida wants to win. I think if anything gets outside of that, it's very, very hard for me to see us winning the game.
This is going to be such a challenge for the Gators. I'm gonna put a number on Felipe Franks' sacks that he takes. If it's 3 and under, good for us. I mean, basically, how clean do we keep him? He hasn't shown that he really understands yet how to climb the pocket. He kind of rolls into those pressures. So some of these, if he gets sacked a lot, often it's on him. We've got to be, you know, I don't know if they're going to be super exotic. They're probably going to be content to let their four guys rush. So can our guys, you know, man up and block those guys? They're probably not going to have to deal with a ton of craziness, I think. Now, they could surprise us in that. So how many sacks is he taking? And then how many explosive plays? You've already talked about this. Do our safeties get put in position where they're losing us the game? And that, I feel like that's going to happen. So I don't know. That I think they have the capability to attack us where we're weak. And it's not. This is going to be a challenge. If the Gators win, it could be that special teams comes into play again. That's the unaccounted for thing here. I think we could have the advantage there. I haven't done all my due diligence on Mississippi State special teams, but I know that we're obviously capable of big plays in that department. All right, I usually ask you for a prediction. I'll give one first here. I think Mississippi State does cover. I'm going to say 28-17.
Our scores are so close to each other this year. It's fun. Sometimes we're divergent. I've got Mississippi State 23, Florida 13. That score feels low to me. It does feel low to me. I mean, I don't think that Mississippi State's defense is perfect, but I just feel like we could be walking into a potential buzzsaw here. More as a very motivational guy. I think this atmosphere is going to be ruckus. I think the city wants it. The fan wants it. I think they all like Dan Mullen. I don't see this as like, oh, I hate Dan Mullen revenge game, but I just think that this is a game.
I want to prove that we still matter.
Yeah, this is a game they want. I think Moorhead wants to prove that his hiring wasn't flawed. So I expect a super dialed in Mississippi State team. I think our team, and I think Dan Mullen continues to emphasize the long term, which I think is great. And I've said this before in the Kentucky loss too. It feels like this season for us is a growth season to get to next year. This Mississippi State season is now. And this game feels like now. And the urgency for them and the home field scenario, it's a night game. It just feels like too much to overcome. So the score, I think, could get higher. But for lack of a better predictive index, I'll stick with that 23-13 level, and they do cover the spread.
I agree. It's more for me about that spread. It feels like an 11-point win. Again, you could slide that scale up 10 points higher for both teams. But that feels about how much better they are than us, outside us outperforming in a particular category or making an improvement that we haven't shown yet, or them collapsing. You know, it's college football. Anything can happen. But some of these predictions, I'm like, man, who knows? This one felt fairly easy to me, at least for how I'm feeling right now. Now, you know, the Gators still have a lot in them in terms of unpredictability and ceiling that we could continue to rise above that. We still do have a lot of talent. We're a technically more talented team than they are. That might not show up on game day. But this feels like where we're at and where they're at, even despite a poor performance against Kentucky the previous week.
And I want to say as a side note, I'm actually really excited about this game.
Yeah.
This is one of the first times in a while that maybe really since the Will Grier era that like each week we're doing things that are competent, and Wilger covered up a lot of our mistakes, right? But we're doing things that are competent. This game becomes intriguing on a football level. I want to see how much better we are. I want to see how we face against the team that should be knowing what we're doing. I want to see how we handle some adversity. It's fun to try to be the underdog like this. And if we do get a win here, and I'm going to put this on record, if we get a win, I'll come back on this podcast on Monday, and I will be extremely excited. No matter how this game looks, no matter how we win this game, if we were to win this game, this would be a big deal for year one Dan Mullen. This would be a win that very, very few people would give us a shot of getting. So it's fun, relish being the underdog. It's not often, if you look at the modern history of Florida, this kind of stuff happens, although it's been our recent history. So I'm going to enjoy this game as an underdog more than I think I have. I'm an underdog with hope, Alan, underdog with hope. All right, national games coming up this weekend. Very quickly here, and then we'll close it out and get you guys on with your week. We'll start, of course, with Florida State. Somehow, a six-point favorite on the road at Louisville.
Louisville's looks super bad. They're flip-flopping quarterbacks. I don't know, but give me Louisville, though, still.
Right? That's the thing. It's impossible to bet Florida State. I don't want to touch this, but at this point in time, don't touch Florida State. All right, Syracuse versus Clemson. The Cuse is undefeated. They're feeling like they have Donovan McNabb at quarterback, and they're back in their golden era. Clemson is...
They beat Clemson last year.
They did. That's what I was going to say. Clemson, interesting. They do not have a settled quarterback situation. Trevor Lawrence is a freshman. He's dropping dimes when he's playing, but he's a freshman. 23 points seems kind of large to me, and this, I'm not sure. It seems like a big spread.
Yeah. The fact that it's at Clemson would make me consider taking them, but I'm going to take Syracuse and all those points.
Yeah, I'm going to take the points here. I think Clemson could get away from Syracuse, but something about that feels too big. All right, my favorite, West Virginia, Will Grier, on the road against Texas Tech, beginning a gauntlet for them where they will be featured each and every week on this National Game of the Week. They are favored only by 4. That feels way too small for me. It feels very reactionary based upon what Texas Tech did last week. I don't know. I know they're good, but that seems small. I like West Virginia in this bet here. And in fact, this will be my national lock of the week.
Whoa. I feel way opposite. I'm very tempted to take Texas Tech here. West Virginia did impress me last week. You know, that even that ho-hum win against Kansas State shows me that they understand what they're doing, what they're trying to accomplish. I would stay far away from this. This feels super unpredictable to me. So
I like it. I like that I go lock of the week and you go stay forward. This will be fun fodder next week. Tennessee on the road against Georgia, which, Alan, I know that you are excited to know, is the 3:30 best conference, best station game of the week on CBS. Georgia is favored by 31.5 points, which I suppose means that they'll be favored by 22 or 3 over us, or it just means that the Vegas odds makers want to get far away from Tennessee.
I don't know if you could have made this high enough. I mean, if you want to put a lock on anything for me, this would be Georgia 31.5. I mean, Kirby Smart fired up that they only won by 25 against Missouri. They're going to pants Tennessee. This, if you got some ducats you want to put down, do it on this one.
Agreed. This is a huge spread. I tend not to want to bet these, but I like this game for a multitude of reasons. All right, Pitt versus UCF. UCF favored by 15. Pitt is more of a real team than what they typically face, although, as I said earlier, when Penn State was a mere 8-point favorite against Pitt, that Pitt is not a good football team.
What do you see? Yeah, give me UCF here, unfortunately.
Yeah, this feels like UCF covers this one. I feel like this is one of those games where
maybe closer early, but they put it away late.
Yeah, look at us. We matter. We beat Pitt by a lot, right? You got to find that narrative. Ohio State, Penn State. Happy Fancy. Valley whiteout. Ohio State favored by 4 in this one. That feels very small for me, the way Haskins is playing.
Yeah, I'm going to take Ohio State here. Penn State's been spunky. I mean, they've looked so much better since that App State game, but that's still lingering for me. Ohio State feels like they got a little too much right now.
I want to make one note on Urban Meyer. We mentioned Urban Meyer last season sort of maybe potentially morphing to more of a professional style of spread offense. You could be seeing iteration of 1.0 with Haskins at the helm. He is not a runner by trade.
No.
He's athletic, but he is a absolute phenomenal passer, and they are way more downfield than they've been in previous years.
They've got great receivers, dangerous running backs.
We talked about Urban being a system guy. Can he adjust? We noticed some of the routes he'd been running in previous years had. Cardell may have opened his eyes when he stole a title. It seems like Urban is not so stuck in the mud with 3 yards and 3 yards and 3 yards. Keep an eye on this Ohio State team. Stanford on the road. Great schedule. Stanford has the Cardinal. Against Notre Dame. Notre Dame, new jolt of energy by changing quarterbacks last week. Now all of a sudden the media is back on the Notre Dame bandwagon, yet they're only favored by 5.
this feels like maybe a potential letdown game for Stanford, in that it's hard to go so high 1 week and then have to back it up again. Now, Stanford feels like they are maybe more capable of that than most teams. Man, I was not feeling Notre Dame, but that win was nice. At Notre Dame, I'll go ahead and take Notre Dame.
Yeah, they looked competent. This one's still tricky. This one is not one I'd want to bet on. I think there's question marks on either team. Stanford, though, like you said, how much energy did they have to expend? And then they fly two-thirds of the way across the country. They switch a time zone. They play in a super fired-up stadium. Touchdown Jesus overlooking them. I'll take Notre Dame here on the points. I don't love it. I think Stanford's proven to be very resilient this year, but Notre Dame feels right there. BYU. It's like Steve Young is back there. They are amped about this team. They are ranked, Allen, and they're playing on the road against a Washington team that has not been able to put it all together, per se. Washington favored by 17.5.
Too many points for me to feel comfortable with that. Washington is not explosive, I think, enough to put away BYU like that. I'll take BYU.
I like that. I like that pick exactly. Ole Miss on the road against LSU, and this might tip the hat a little bit to the Ed O pick, like we mentioned. What's the spread here, Allen? It's only 12.5. Only 12.5, but do you want to touch that spread?
Man, if Ole Miss had come out and put it on Kent State, I would feel better about this. LSU, I'm just still not a believer. I'm with you. Maybe it's the Coach O funk on me still. It feels like they're going to play this close. I'll take the points at Ole Miss.
This is just so hard to predict because there's the LSU defense that comes out and plays like they have to win this game and they'll shut people down. And there's the LSU defense that comes out and plays like, you know, I'm casually interested. And then the offense plays like I'm casually interested. And I don't know. I don't love this one either. I do continue to like the work that's going on down there in Ole Miss. But I think when you see lines like this, it kind of indicates the fact that Vegas isn't really sure what to do. LSU is immensely more talented than Ole Miss is. So I suppose I'll take LSU here, but I wouldn't like it. Oregon, -3 after just a heartbreaking loss on the road at a surprising Cal team that no one's talking about, but is undefeated and snuck into the rankings.
I'm tempted to take Cal, but I think that would be too much of an overreaction or putting too much on Oregon to recover. I think the quarterback is going to be Justin Herbert is going to be too much for them. I'll take them even giving 3.
I like Oregon, and if I had to pick who was going to win the Pac-12 right now, I'd pick Oregon after watching that Stanford game. Now, I don't know if they recover. Like you mentioned, their college kid is emotional, but that they looked excellent in that Stanford game at times. I mean, truly excellent. Kind of a shame they lost, because you kind of want to see a team like that represent for a while. But either way, interesting game here. Let's see if they can bounce back. And as you said, not let the previous team beat you twice. Allen, any other thoughts before we close up the pod?
This is such an interesting time in Gator football. I looked at this, you know, the schedule at the beginning of the season, and I was like, I'm not looking forward to this Mississippi State slot because it feels like we're going to get upended here after a good start. Now, we've had a little bit more adversity that we've been facing, you know, through the Kentucky game. I have hope. I even though I predict us to lose by a comfortable margin, it doesn't feel like doom and gloom. We're like, we can't do anything. We have no hope. There is hope for me in this on the upside, but just feels like it's a little too much, Mississippi State. But exciting moment to be a Gator fan. It feels like instead of the McElwain era, which started kind of high and just kept trending down, feels like we're a lower spot where we're trending up.
Yeah, that's well said. That's well said. And I feel exactly the same. I'm really excited about another great weekend of college football. And I am very excited to see how we handle this latest test. Kentucky was a surprise. This is not a surprise. This is not a pop quiz exam. So we know what we're getting into. Let's see how well we can handle our business. With that, we will shut this episode of the Gator Nation Football Podcast down. As always, thank you so much for listening, guys and girls. Thanks so much for the feedback. It really does make Allen and I's week. Each of us have different professional lives, but whenever we get feedback from you telling how much you like the show or how it's a part of your daily routine, it's just so cool to hear that. We're humbled by your support. We love doing the podcast, and we look forward to discussing whatever happens this weekend with you next week. See you guys then.